Welcome to the Desperately Seeking Self podcast, the podcast that's exploring the not-so-filtered side of life and giving you no BS strategies, tips, and tools, and maybe a little laughter along the way so you can fall in love with your life again. I'm your host, Brooke Collins. Let's get started. Hi, everyone. I'm so excited today to have Megan Swan, a mindset and wellness professional, coach, professional, and so much more. I am like so excited to have you here today. I can't begin to tell you how like excited I am to dive in. So let's just dive in. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into mindfulness and wellness, and we'll move on from there.
Sure. Thanks, Brooke, so much for having me. It's an honor. It's been, like most, I think, people, a journey to get to coaching. I started out in the world of wellness, almost 15 years ago now, becoming interested in yoga. And then I got certified to be a yoga teacher. And I kind of jokingly, that was like my gateway, quote unquote, drug into the wellness world. But I still didn't live a very balanced life for the first 10 years of being a yoga teacher. But it was the beginning point where I started to be more aware of how things that I put into my body affect my emotions, my mind, and my body. But I still had a long way to go. So then it wasn't really until like 10 years later when I became a mother. And I think most women, it's pretty socially acceptable that we start to become really hyper aware of what we're consuming when we're pregnant. And many of us like do all this research. I mean, like right off the bat, most of us take alcohol off the table and start becoming like really paranoid about what we're eating and all these things. And so at some point I just kind of, I was pregnant, then I was breastfeeding, then I was pregnant and I was breastfeeding. So it's like almost like 4 years. And that gave me a lot of insight into how I wanted to, you know, what was the normal that I really wanted to get back to. And we can go into that more, but that was what sparked my need to find my own health coach, which then sparked my interest into becoming one. And since then, I've brought in to be more inclusive of all sorts of wellness. I work in terms of physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual wellness. And for all of those things to have sustainable long-term changes for anyone, it requires a mindset shift. So that's where the mindset piece comes in.
Well, yeah. And I feel like becoming a mother is like a perfect example, because you have to almost give up your selfish rights to your body. Most women do so willingly because we're carrying a human life and we know we're creating a life force. But I think that for me specifically, that was a big eye opener. So I'm glad you brought that up, because I was not really in tune with my body by what I was putting into it. With my first daughter, I got pregnant really young with her. I was 23, and it was just a whole different scenario than my second one, who I had at 33. So I learned from pregnancy, like what made me feel like, let's say, sluggish, right? Or what made mm-hmm. me feel, I didn't realize that things could affect me to feel like my heart rate rise, or, you know, especially in pregnancy. And then even after pregnancy, my hormones have changed. So I get like anxious very quickly if I put the wrong things in my body, sugar specifically, because I don't drink, obviously, but sugar will cause me to have, I mean, borderline panic attacks. And I'm still working on accepting that's what happens, because I want to think that
we all love sugar.
Exactly.
Yeah, well, it's a big piece. I have many clients. I mean, I'm also a detox expert, and I think it's pretty, I mean, it could be a whole other podcast probably. It's pretty common that in recovery, we need to find some other vice. And, you know, thankfully there's all of these fun, sober beverages coming out on the market, but a lot of them do contain other things that, you know, shift your state mentally, even physically. So I think becoming, you know, pregnancy is this natural time that we become more aware of how we feel and the direct connection of what we're consuming. And then, like you say, it carries over partly because your hormones shift from then on forever in some way. And it's, you know, you can't let go of that new awareness that you have. And it's harder to keep up a behavior when there's like this very clear connection for you that when I do this, I feel this. And in my case, sugar, it's like, I lose my patience. I get angry a lot faster. So, but yeah, I love a good dessert.
I get hungover from it too. I feel like being in recovery, the dopamine hit that I, or is it serotonin, whichever one I'm getting, trying to look for, the hit it gives me, there are nights that I overdo it without even realizing I'm overdoing it. And then, I mean, the next day it's exactly like I am like fatigued and I'm like out of sorts. And it's an interesting dynamic that it's the one thing we all love so much. And yet I think it's a interesting thing to put in your body because it causes disease. And the more you read up on it, the inflammation and the everything that it does, but it is good. It tastes so good.
Yeah. Well, and there's many experts that think it'll be the next tobacco, if you will, like that they're going to start regulating that long before anyone's going to have a conversation about alcohol, for example, but we'll see. I mean, there's a whole other global epidemic of problems around sugar consumption. Yeah. And really like the
pandemic of problems around, but before we get into, because I love your take on like natural looking for healness, I like anything that I can heal my body without needing to medicate myself. I'm really a big believer of trying to utilize food as the needs to sustain my body for vitamins and minerals and you know, all of the things that we need to keep going. First of all, when I look at your website, I'm looking at it now because I had your About Me page. You're just so vibrant. And I know this is a podcast so people can't see you, but your energy is so, it's magnetic. And even through a website, just your dynamic, spunky personality shines through. And I love anybody who is brave enough to do like an Eat, Pray, Love story. Cause when that book came out and when that movie came out with Julia Roberts, like I was obsessed with it. And I wanted to do it. And then I was like, no, yes, no. But you, tell me a little bit about how you're living your own Eat, Pray, Love journey.
Sure. Well, thank you so much for the kind words on my website. I just redid it. So that's so nice to hear. I think love that book, you know, like I very much remember, you know, being excited that the movie came out and, you know, all the ins and outs of whether it did it justice, but really the book was transformational for me. I have several parts of that book that I always go back and reread because it's really brilliant. But I think what I related to, and I think many women relate to, is this desire for this answer, this external answer. And that's why you go on this journey. And, you know, I think even in the book, you'll learn. And I learned even on my first stop. So the short version of mine is at 30, I had been working in Toronto. I, you know, wanted to climb the managerial ladder of big non-for-profits like Amnesty International and that kind of thing. Like I was big into human rights and identity issues. And it was just like really depressing. It was not only working day to day to try and fight those issues, but just how competitive it was for these jobs that you basically didn't ever, you know, like very competitive for very low paying salaries, and people were, you know, much more educated than I was. You know, I didn't have the year three working in Africa, and I just was starting to get really discouraged at 30. And so, not to mention, I had a relationship that, you know, I wanted to go one way and he wanted to go travel the world, but he never quite got there. And I beat him to the punch. So I, at 30, went to Mexico. My mom and her husband invited me because they knew that I was kind of struggling emotionally to get some sort of traction going in Toronto. And I came back from that trip being like, you know what? I'm moving to Mexico. I'm going on my own Eat, Pray, Love. I'm going to go a year to Mexico, then a year to Bali, and then a year, I don't know where, I'll see where the world takes me. And so I sort of, you know, graciously, meaning like took a couple months to properly exit my job, and I got certified to teach English. And I already had the certification to teach yoga. So I figured like between the two, I could kind of hand to mouth live as I go. And yeah, that was the plan. But long story short, it's 12 years later and I'm still in my first stop here in Mexico. So,
well, Mexico has a spirit. Its heartbeat is loud, and it is its own magnetic place. I've been all over Mexico traveled as a kid and in my early 20s, obviously to more tourist spaces. There's just a feeling there that I have personally felt that is, I don't know if it's the ocean and the geography, and the people are so welcoming and friendly and kind. It's like all encompassing, you know. When I came back from there, at one point I was like, I'm going to go to like Mexico City. I want to go to the university. I want to do like a year, like traveling abroad. That my life didn't take me down that path, but that was definitely a plan. So I get why you would end up staying. I mean, it's just an amazing place, especially I think for people who feel things so deeply and empathetically and have intuitive, to be in a place that just helps you center yourself.
Yeah, well, I think they're just so much better culturally. As a culture, they're so much better at living in the present moment than we in Western culture are. So everything from having like gigantic parties for every child's birthday, every baptism, forget like the weddings are 500 plus, but a child's birthday party is 100 plus invites. And that's just, you know, what you do. And so it's celebrating, being more in the moment. Even in Spanish, there's no word for losing time. No, sorry. You don't waste time. They don't have a word like as we refer, so-and-so's, you wasted my time, or because that has a sense of blame, you know, like you can target who's wasting whose time. Whereas in Spanish, you just lose time. Like no one has control of it. It's just, there it went. That like, you know, how could I've lost time. I was just in a deep conversation with someone and I'm sorry I arrived late, but you know, obviously I was living in the moment kind of thing. So that's a huge generalization on the day-to-day here in Mexico, but I feel that and felt that from the beginning. And I think living here has allowed me to tune in, to slow down, to be all the things that I wanted to be in different ways that I don't think I would have found in Canada.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously I'm in the States, but I consider Toronto to be, I'm in Michigan anyways, outside of Detroit. So it's a fairly similar, you know, geography. And I think, you know, Canadians, I think similarly to at least the Midwesterners in the country, my country. But I think it's interesting the way that you put that. There is no word for wasting time. That it's you know, I lost time doing whatever, because I like that you said it's putting the emphasis of blame on something else other than it is being in the moment, right? Like I can lose time. I mean, my biggest time suck right now would be my phone, but then there's nobody to blame but me for that, right? So I've got to, I think that living in the moment, and I'm still not great at it. I plan ahead. I have ADHD, you know, I'm in recovery. Like things are always sort of swirling in my mind. So for me to center myself is difficult, but living in the day, that's something I've gained with sobriety that is a huge gift to my life, because before that I was always wrapped up in the next thing or the next month or the next, you know, year where I was going, and being able to just be in today, there's something so it creates abundance for me to be able to be present no matter what. And it sounds like where you are, there's a huge abundance of presence, even in the way that culturally you live. Cause when we were chatting when I met you last week, we were chatting about how your family, you know, your family lives across the hall. Like you guys are all, it's the way that things are, the culture is so different in that regard, you know, like I'm like 4 miles from my parents' house, you know, and even, and some people would consider that too close because I can, you know, be there in a few minutes. So, do you find it difficult, being so in tune with your empathetic, abilities, like being so close to people all the time or no?
Honestly, sometimes, I mean, I know myself pretty well, and I, in that sense, I don't align perfectly with the culture, and that I can get saturated with being so social. But I can see my kids who are half Mexican, obviously. So maybe I didn't, and the eat, pray, love was that I fell in love with one of my English students, and who I was, he's a surgeon, and I was giving him private English classes. And so that was like two months into arriving here in Mexico. And 12 years later, we're still together and we have two kids. So I see in them that they are much more able to hold space. Like they, in fact, they feel more comfortable when there's always people around. Whereas, because I grew up in in the prairies, in a city in Canada, in Calgary, Alberta. And it's more just a cultural thing, like not only in terms of social space, but also noise. That's like another thing. And I'm also a highly sensitive person. So like I'm the person that if the filter in the car is like allowing the exhaust to come in, like I can tell immediately and nobody else seems to be bothered. And I also can't get to sleep if there's like one little light on something charging like in my eye. So I, like all these little things, and it's made it, I don't know. I guess it's brought me a different awareness, and I really get energized from spending a lot of like quality time in these scenarios. But then I also need to take a break. Whereas I feel like a lot, I hate to generalize like a whole culture, but here culturally, people are just so used to living with more generations of their family. That generally speaking, like they don't do 100% alone very well. They prefer to have like someone around, even though you're not actively interacting with them per se.
Just a presence in the room with them. So, you know, I think that's culturally actually most of the world, except for westernized, you know.
Totally. Yeah.
I mean, I really do, because I have friends in Europe whose in-laws and, you know, they're multicultural too. And it's living very similarly to the way that Mexico, you know, the way you're describing where you are in your pocket of Mexico. But I think that's pretty prevalent all over in cultures where it's family-based and people-based. It's a whole different shift, right? When you move there, that has to be very exciting, very energetic. And then you fall in love, which has to add to your, you know, your whole eat, pray, love, like, oh, and now I've met this man. And I'm curious, just because, so did he not speak English when you guys met? Like you were teaching him English, or was it, he was like, you know, okay with English, but wanted to get better? Or did he just think you were cute and want to have lessons with you?
Well, it's kind of a funny story, but the short of it is, you know, he had basic English, and I understood he spoke a lot more than he really understood. So he was very good at just kind of like nodding and smiling at everything I said. And I also, at the beginning of our relationship, sort of assumed that he wanted to continue our relationship, like that it was some sort of benefit that our relationship was in English. So, because it wasn't really until because at the time I was still living in an English bubble, you know, like I taught at an English school and they encouraged us to not speak any Spanish to our students. And I had all expat friends. And so I had learned enough Spanish to get by, but I wasn't fluent. And it wasn't until that I really dedicated myself to learning Spanish properly, which would have been like 2 years into living here, that, well, it was partly when I decided like, okay, I'm going to be staying here longer. And I'm going to open a yoga studio and I need to be able to speak Spanish properly. And that's when our relationship took on a different level, because really we had like a very superficial understanding, I think, which sometimes can be nice. I jokingly say that, you know, a lot of your friends were a lot more charming before I understood like every single word that came out of their mouths, you know? And sometimes in relationships, you know, the sort of like joke of the elderly couple that can like barely hear each other anymore. There's something sometimes when less is said.
I would have to think, I feel like when you turned up the passion, when you really stepped into speaking the Spanish though, because Spanish to me is just such a powerful, beautiful language. The way it rolls off your tongue. I took 4 years of Spanish and in early college, I've lost most of it, which I could kick myself for. If I wanted to reimmerse myself, I could move somewhere probably and get it back, you know, in a minimal, not years, you know, but I just, from the minute I started taking a Spanish class, the whole language just, I mean, it speaks to me. I know it's a language, but it really, the way that the words are pronounced and the way that the sentences roll together is so much prettier than English could ever try to be. And it just feels, there's like a fire behind it that I love. I do. I love listening to people speak Spanish. I used to watch telenovelas all the time, you know, just to like, there's so much more feeling, I feel like.
Yeah, it's a lot more flowery, you know, like it's, yeah, there's like, it's just an intention of making it sound pretty, which, I mean, we can, it's like a whole other rabbit hole we can go down, like, but at the beginning of living in a foreign country, it's kind of like any marriage, right? So there's like this honeymoon period where everything's exotic and new and exciting. And then, you know, as years go by, you start to see what's really happening. And so I think I would have like a few other things to say about that, but in terms of just how it sounds, it's much more lyrical. Like it sounds like a song. And like I'm just so grateful that my boys are bilingual and also just, you know, growing up with two different cultures.
I think that's incredible. I think that's the best way for people to grow up. All of my friends that are bilingual, bicultural, like they have so much more of a grasp globally than I could even pretend to like act like I know what I'm talking about. And I think it's just creates a whole new level for both parents and kids when you mix cultures and you mix languages. It's just it's a unique place, I think, to be able to empower your kids to sort of own who they are from both places. Cause I'm sure there's things that are Canadian that you miss, you know, that are like traditions and things that you had growing up. And I think it's a beautiful, your whole story is beautiful, being, you know, trying to get out of something. Most people wouldn't have the balls, honestly, to do what you did, quite frankly. I think that is the fear factor creeps in, and people will say all day long that they want to take this leap, that they want to do something, and they don't do it. And for you to be able to just take the leap and listen to your soul calling, saying like, no, this is where I'm supposed to go. This is what I'm supposed to do. And even in terms of not being fluid with the plan that you had and still staying there and being married and having kids and like changing your life over for that. Like to me, that's a special talent that not a lot of people, it's not a talent, I guess it's a confidence maybe, that listening to your intuition and your inner guidance. And it's saying like, no, I'm going to stay, I'm going to do this. And then actually listening to it. Cause I don't know about you, but I can talk myself out. I'll listen, have an intuitive hit. And then I'm like, oh no, that no, I'll like talk myself out of it. And then I always regret it down the road, you know? Cause I'm like, God, I knew that this was the wrong choice. And that there I was trying to rationalize. Have you always followed your gut or where you've wanted to, you know, where you feel the universe is taking you, or is that taking practice for you?
Well, I think the way I was raised in a few ways, like travel was really valued. My parents thought that it was really like the best education that we could have. So early in our childhoods, it was, I mean, we had like our summer travel, but more as young adults, we got to go to Europe, and that like completely changed my perspective of the world. And I think when you start to see what's possible from a different lens, then it becomes less fearful. And so sometimes, you know, like probably if I'd never left the country, I wouldn't, you know, right. By the time I was coming back from Mexico, I'd been to, you know, 20 plus countries in Europe, and I'd been to India, and I feel like it's like this thing that you build up, you expand your ability to do something so crazy. But I definitely, you know, I was taught to, my dad taught me to take risks. He always used to take us down like double black diamond ski thing routes when we were like eight and 11. And, you know, with this confidence that we'd be able to figure it out. And I just remember like feeling like I'm hanging off cliffs in the Rocky Mountains sometimes. And, but just like those things that you remember, and it's like, and you get out of it, you do it. And so I think, I kind of liked, well, and I can say even in the last year, I've reflected on my constant moving around. I also, was married earlier. My first marriage was when I was 23, and I moved to the United States with him. I lived in Minneapolis and then in Houston. So I just didn't see it as, I guess, that crazy. And it was always on my radar that I wanted to travel more of the world. And at 30, I knew, like, you know, I don't have a significant other. I don't have children. Like, if I don't drop everything now, the likelihood of me doing it in another 10 years is pretty slim to none. So I'm not saying it's not possible, but that was my thinking at the time. And I think, yeah, I mean, there was just something about Mexico. I had an experience on a dance floor in Puerto Vallarta. I was like dancing by myself, and the DJ, who's like the only other person in the club at the time, came, he's like, telling me, like, I just love how you dance, like no one's watching. And I'm like, well, part of me thought like no one is watching, but mostly it was just like there was something about that trip that got me back to feeling like myself before the series of relationships at that point that had me really questioning like who I was without anybody attached. And I just knew that there was something out there. I had no idea what it was, but I just knew.
Well, it was greater. It was big enough to call you towards it, which is, you know, that's the compelling part. I love that you traveled. I love that you were raised by someone who just wanted you to have the confidence that you'd be able to figure it out, and had the confidence that in you that you would be able to figure it out also, instead of, what do they call this?
The helicopter.
Parenting. Yeah. You know, and that's interesting, because I was just having a conversation with a girlfriend about how, you know, when we were kids, we would play outside all the time. Like, I was talking to you about this too, like in, about electronics. And I said, you know, my kids don't, they play outside and they go to the pool, and it's so yuppie. Like, they play golf on their golf course, and they go to the pool, and they do tennis, and they like to be outside, obviously, but it's not the same as like when I was a kid. I would be in our backyard, and I would make the tree line, like the tree line would be like this whole nother city. And I could come up with like an entire movie in my, but it was like in real life, I was playing it, you know? And My younger daughter is more imaginative. I think uses her imagination. She's more empathic. So that explains it probably and intuitive, but she's able to like get into a different world more so than my analytical firstborn. But I just have been really like, my younger one gets afraid really easily. She's very sensitive, highly sensitive. The loud noises bother her and crowded places bother her. And you know, it's just something I've been leaning into, like, God, am I doing my kids a disservice by like not letting them, giving them my confidence that they're capable of whatever and figuring it out. And I feel like I'm just tying in nature because I feel like that's where kids have the opportunity to learn it more so than on a device or in you know, a classroom environment almost.
Yeah. Well, I think there's so many layers to this. Like one, my mom always brings to my attention, you know, like the, there wasn't the pressure on parents even 20 years ago to be the best parent in the world. Like they weren't as obsessed with, you know, they were just doing what they thought was best or like, you know, doing what everyone else was doing in terms of parenting. And there wasn't, you know, like no one was studying up on how to be the best, you know, conscious parent. So there's that there's all this pressure and we're like overanalyzing how we're doing it. But I think there's also like a real life reality that there is more reason to be fearful in certain situations. I would argue that we've sort of, you know, extrapolated that or exaggerated it a little bit too much sometimes. And that I really seek out, you're saying like, what do I miss about Canada? For me, going to our cabin in northern Saskatchewan, like essentially in the middle of nowhere in the forest. It's not as like a small town, but you know, that's like one of few places in the world that I feel like I can let my kids go like, you know, 12 houses, one or either direction. And I'm not like absolutely deathly afraid that I can't see them. And part of living here in Mexico, that's just, it's very much a part of the culture that people, you know, you just stick with the people that you know you can trust, and you generally have a little bit of fear, whether it's real or not, about everyone else. And I think increasingly it's not just in dangerous parts of the world. Like, you know, I know growing up in Calgary, like we knew pretty well our neighbors, like two or three houses out. And it's not to say that we like socialized with them regularly, although I know like on my mom's street in Calgary, they have like, you know, street parties or whatever once in a while. But increasingly, like when I've lived in different places in the world in an apartment building, for example, I didn't really know even everyone on the floor, and you kind of like avoid having these personalized interactions, or like, it's like we've got this sort of sterilization of interacting with strangers. And I think like, I really don't want to pass that on to my kids. And my oldest, he, you know, like we were in New York, what would that have been, almost 3 years ago now. And they love Central Park, and, you know, they go and like introduce themselves and make friends at the park in Central Park. And like, you know, he still asks about so-and-so from Finland and like, how can we get in touch with them? And I love that about him. Really consciously don't, you know, stop him. Like, however, here in the local park, he knows he can't tell anyone or point like where our house is in relative to the park, you know, like, it's this perceived, and the reality of when you, I think it's more so than the cartels, honestly, it's the reality of when you live in a country where the gap between the very wealthy and the very poor is so huge, that's just, there's a security issue.
I would assume that would be, you'd get more of a fear. I could see being a parent and being afraid, because my kids are, my youngest is like, my mom's phone number is 248, like, you know, like she just wants, call my mom, she'll set up a play date like wherever we are. And you know, we had to talk to her repeatedly about, and we don't have the same issue where I am, but like, you don't need to tell everyone our address. Everybody doesn't need to know that you live, you know, where we live, and it's okay to just say I live in this subdivision, because I live, you know, in the States, there's a lot of subdivision, and I'm lucky enough that in my sub, we do know our neighbors. I think that's because it's its own little community. You know, we do have a neighborhood pool up front. So in the summer, you know, people are congregating up there and we get to know our neighbors. But in my last neighborhood, I was like, you know, didn't want people to see me, didn't want to, was very private and not wanting to connect with my neighbors. It's just funny the way that we have the ability to not want to connect with people that are around us, because like we were talking about last week, with kids in particular, it takes a village, right? It takes a strong village. Hey guys, there was so much great information in the interview that I had to make a second part of the interview for another episode. So the good news is, stay tuned next week for the second part of the interview. Loved this episode of the Desperately Seeking Self podcast? Head over to iTunes to subscribe, rate, and leave a review. I really appreciate it. And thanks for listening. For free resources and materials, head over to my website at innovativecoachbrooke.com. Thanks so much. Have a good week.